We're very privileged this morning to have Gary Kinsman. He is a professor at the University of Calgary. He's also an author, and he's written extensively. He's a Canadian sociologist, and he's one of Canada's leading academics on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues. He's been doing this work for decades. He's written extensively on the subject, and we're very privileged to have him on our show. He's a professor of sociology at Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario. Thank you again for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning, Gary. Thank you. Now, we will be celebrating Pride Day on August 1st. And, you know, it would seem that we live in a society that has gender equality. Paint a picture for us. Where are we today in Canada in terms of gender equality issues?
Well, certainly there's been major advances both in relationship to gender struggles for social justice and also sexual-related struggles for social justice, but there's still an awful long way to go. I mean, major things have been won, but there's still major things that need to be battled for. I guess the way to perhaps best think about this is a distinction between formal equality, that is sort of formal equality as individuals under the law, versus the forms of substantive inequality that and injustice and hatred and violence that women still face, that trans people still face, and that certainly queer people more generally face in our society. So there's been amazing advances, from human rights protection for lesbians and gay men to various gender equality struggles to same-sex relationship recognition to same-sex marriage. All of these have been important victories that when I first got involved in the gay liberation movement in the 1970s, you know, certainly I wouldn't necessarily have anticipated that we would have won by this point in time, but we have won them, but there's still an awful long way to go. There's still lots of hatred and violence towards queer people and trans people out there on the streets. There's still pervasive discrimination against young queer people in high schools and on the streets. There's still forms of censorship that exist in relationship to our sexualities and in terms of gender identities and gender variants and trans issues. There's still an awful lot of issues that we have to tackle. So in a certain sense, we've established formal legal equality in a number of areas, not in all areas, but we haven't yet achieved substantive social equality or liberation. And I think one of the ways you can see that is, you know, if you sort of scratch the surface of liberal tolerance towards trans people or queer people, you will often see pretty vicious signs of hatred and bigotry towards us. And I think the reason for that, even with all these gains, is that we haven't got at the real roots of the problem, which is the social relations of sexism, heterosexism, the two-gender binary system that still dominates our society. These are what we really have to get to achieve more substantive social equality.
How does sexism exacerbate the inequality in society and contribute to maintain this hierarchically organized system of inequality?
Well, sexism is quite central to how oppression and domination are organized in our society. The sort of domination in general still to this day of men over women, even though there's been major strides that the feminist movement has made, is still a pervasive feature in our society, in workplaces, in waged work, in households. I mean, we have to remember that still the vast majority of domestic and reproductive labor is done by women in our society, and it's not paid for. Therefore, given we live in a capitalist society where you have to have a wage, you have to have money to have power in our society, it means that women are, you know, quite unequal to men in lots of ways. And we also know in the waged workforce that women still continue to earn less than men. We know that there's pervasive forms of both sexual and non-sexual violence that continue to be organized against women in their everyday lives. And it also divides the working class, if you want to put it that way, by putting sort of the male section of the working class on top, so to speak, of the women's section or the female section of the working class. It causes pervasive divisions in our society. And until we actually get at the roots of sexism, we're also not able to address the roots of the oppression of queer people or trans people, because our oppression is also bound up with the oppression that women experience in our society.
One of the things I'm interested in is the way institutions contribute to inequality, both economic, social, and cultural distinction. What role has the education system played in continuing gender inequality?
I mean, the education system plays a major part. I mean, it's certainly, quite a participating type of institutional network in these sets of relationships that organize sexism and heterosexism. One of the things about the education system is on the sort of ideological level, it claims that everyone gets treated equally, that everyone has sort of equal rights and equal possibilities for advancement. When we look at what actually happens is that the school system, despite those claims to equality for all, actually continues through its hidden curriculum, through its official curriculum, through the very ways in which schools are organized, the ways in which men still oftentimes, especially at the higher levels in education, still have more power than women, even though there's been major changes there. What we see is there's a continuing reproduction or a continuing production of sexism and gender inequality and streaming of people into different types of job classifications and job destinations and careers that continue to perpetuate a sexist gender division of labor in which men still have more power and more privilege than women, and even though women have made major advances. There's also major problems within the school system and the education system when it comes to trans people and queer people. I mean, the very form, the sort of assumed normality of heterosexuality and the heterosexual family in the school system means that schools can still be what I often describe as sort of heterosexist regimes of terror for young trans and queer people in our society. And I think we have to begin to deal with this in a more radical way, that is getting to the root of the problem way, than we have so far. It's not just a question of making some modifications to the curriculum or having sort of more out queer people in the schools or having more women in positions of authority. It's also that we have to challenge the very sort of social form of education, which is based on sexism and heterosexism. So we really need a more profound challenge to education so it can really deal with substantive equality and developing that and end its participation in reproducing sexism and heterosexism.
One of your latest books is The Canadian War on Queers, National Security as Sexual Regulation. How has this idea of the law as legitimizing institution contributed to the exacerbation of inequality and discrimination for gays and lesbians?
It's really important to point out that oftentimes how discrimination and prejudice and domination and exclusion are organized is through institutions and through the law, especially if you're looking at the national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men, but also national security campaigns against any group of people that's been sort of expelled from the fabric of the nation, and oftentimes right now Muslim and Arab-identified people living in Canada are expelled from the fabric of the Canadian nation. What you see is that centrally accomplished and organized through laws and institutions, and it's not simply just the individual prejudices of, let's say, security officers or the police that produce this. It's the actual laws, it's the actual national security policies that, for instance, in the Canadian War on Queers, constructed lesbians and gay men per se because we supposedly suffered from a character weakness as being risks to Canadian national security and therefore supposedly vulnerable to blackmail from evil Soviet agents. Interestingly enough, of all the people we talked to, the only people they mentioned whoever tried to blackmail them was the RCMP themselves, trying to get the names of other lesbians and gay men out of the lesbians and gay men they were interrogating. So certainly the law, the police, the national security apparatus, various institutions have played an absolutely central role in organizing discrimination and oppression. It's not just sort of bad ideas in individual people's heads, although sometimes there are bad ideas in people's heads that lead them to bigotry and prejudice. It's how those laws, those institutions, those social relations systematically organize these problems for women, for lesbians and gay men, for trans people in our everyday lives. So we need a broader type of institutional transformation, challenging those institutions and policies. Doing educational work with individuals, for instance, with the police, trying to do sensitivity training around lesbian and gay or trans issues, is important, but it's not in and of itself going to get to the root of the problem. We have to change the laws. We have to change the way in which the police and the law are organized if we're really going to move towards more liberation for people.
One of the things that come to mind immediately when you're talking about the way the law has been used to not only legitimize injustice has been the use of the law against same-sex unions. Can you talk a little bit about how this impacts not only the fabric of the families involved, but also the communities at large? Why it harms us all to have these kinds of, you know, sexist and discriminating policies in place?
Well, I mean, if we look at the whole history of family law, marriage law, I mean, it's based on a very patriarchal history of the domination of men over women and their families, right? I mean, you know, for centuries and centuries, women were basically seen as the property of men. You know, it's important to remember it's only in 1983 in Canada that it became legally possible for a husband to be charged with raping his wife. Prior to that point in time, a woman's body, the wife's body, was seen as simply being the sexual property of the man, and he could have unrestricted access to it. That was only changed through years of organizing by the feminist movement, and was a very, very important and useful change. So there's a whole history of the family and marriage that's been very patriarchal in character, that's constructed only some types of families and support networks as being normal, that deserve state support. And it's been really a problem for lots of lesbians and gay men that we've been defined when we have relationships and that we raise children together as not being proper families, as not being proper relationships, as not really having spouses, as not having the sort of formal legal right to marry. And it's been absolutely crucial that we've been able to win, at least on major levels, those battles for recognition of lesbian and gay families as actually being families, recognizing that we can actually have spousal relationships that get recognized under the law, and also same-sex marriage. But it's also important to point out there's a bit of a problem here. The same-sex marriage struggle has been an important one and a vital victory, and it's especially important in places like Argentina and other countries where people have been actually mobilizing and putting a lot of energy into it. But in Canada, we actually faced a choice. We could have actually decided not to simply go for being let into what have largely been heterosexist and patriarchal institutions like marriage, for instance. We could have actually said, well, maybe we should do it differently. Maybe we should try and organize relationships that have more democracy, more mutuality, more consent, more empowerment involved in them. And I think in some ways, even though winning the legal right to marriage for same-sex couples has been absolutely crucial and vital, we missed a historic opportunity in alliance with the feminist movement and other movements of people to argue for different types of relationships between people. Because the position I put forward, which is not necessarily popular in sort of the mainstream lesbian and gay community that's fought really hard for same-sex marriage, is that, yes, we absolutely have to have the right to marry, because, of course, if that's denied to us and it's only given to heterosexuals, it's a major form of discrimination against us. But on the other hand, to privilege marriage over and against other types of relationships that people have in our society is also a social practice of discrimination. So it seems to me that feminism and lesbian gay liberation need to push further in terms of trying to establish relationships of mutuality and equality. But on the ground, for lots of people, winning the right to same-sex marriage, spousal recognition, that we can actually adopt children, has made an incredible difference in the lives of many lesbians and gay men, especially those of us who are raising kids together.
How can people break the cycle of discrimination that seems to me endemic and part and parcel of a capitalist system that's organized on exploitation?
I mean, it's important for us to realize that there's no one place that we can sort of centrally focus. We need to sort of try to challenge and refuse and break those connections at many, many different points. And in different people's experiences and lives and struggles, those breaking points, those moments of saying, no, you know, I'm not going to continue to experience this oppression, you know, I've put up with this long enough, I'm not going to put up with it any further, those moments are going to come for different people and different groups of people at different points in time. I think the most crucial thing is for us to recognize that all of those different struggles, those different rupture points, those different moments of refusal, those different moments of challenge, we need to start to link them together, to link those different struggles together, whether they're related explicitly to gender oppression and exploitation, whether they're related to lesbian and gay or sexual oppression, whether they're related to the pervasive forms of racialization and racism that exist in our society towards people of color and indigenous people, whether they're related to class questions, whether they're related to poverty, whether they're related to age, whether they're related to ability. We need to begin to figure out how we can connect all of those struggles together and see how all of those struggles, you know, impact on all of us, and how beginning to support other people's struggles can actually open up the door for us towards a socially transformed type of society in which all of the various forms of oppression and exploitation could actually be challenged, and we can actually begin to envisage what a different type of society without capitalism and without oppression might begin to look like. And I think one of the important things for me about some of the struggles that have been going on over the last 10 years or so in terms of the global justice movement, climate justice movements, the lesbian and gay movements, the feminist movement, has been that we've been trying to develop new types of relationships in the midst of those struggles. We can't develop totally new types of relationships because we're still bound up within forms of capitalist oppression and exploitation and other forms of oppression, but we can begin to prefigure or point towards the types of social relations that could exist if we could actually move beyond or rupture with capitalism and oppression. It seems to me those moments of insight that we can actually live our lives in different ways, that another world is not only possible, but it's beginning to emerge in small little glimpses here and there, that can really give us a lot of hope and optimism to continue our struggle. So it's really important for us to listen to other people, to learn from their struggles, and to also see how their struggles can be part of transforming the social worlds that we're part of as well.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Gary Kinsman. His latest book, The Canadian War on Queers, National Security as Sexual Regulation. How can people access your book?
I'm sure in Vancouver, Little Sisters is one of the places that they can get the book. And I should just point out the book's also co-authored with Patricia Gentile. But Little Sisters, I'm sure it's now getting into other major bookstores in Vancouver as well. It's published by the University of British Columbia Press, so if people have any problems accessing it, they can always contact UBC Press directly. And if you actually just Google UBC Press or the Canadian War on Queers, you'll get lots of information about how to access it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Take care.